I said I would open the year doing what I normally scatter through the year by speaking every Sunday for seven Sundays on the seven messages I've been repeating every year for 20 years. Now since five Sundays have passed, or four, you're all sure you've figured out which one I'm going to speak on today. Because of the seven, one is a Mother's Day message. And it ain't Mother's Day yet. And the other is the Easter message. And it's not Easter yet. So that leaves only one. And you all, how many of you think you've got it figured out? Most of you are scared to. Well, you're wrong. Why do I have to wait till Easter? See, the devil makes sure that those that need the Easter message don't come on Easter. And I caught him napping. Some of them are here today. So fasten your mental seat belts and get ready for the most difficult message that I speak, because I'd like to have about 7 hours. For 20 years I tried to get this message across in 1 hour. Did it once. Today I'm looking at 35 minutes on the clock. So you better grease your bearings and pull your brain from wherever it is, fasten your mental seat belts, and get ready to move with me. Yeah, I have a total intolerance of those people that think you can park your brain when you come into church. If you had a brain, you wouldn't go to most churches. But if you come to this one, you better not park your brain. I have total intolerance for the attitude of people that you're born an expert in religion. Most people of intelligence will study a subject before they talk with any authority. But everybody thinks they're born an expert in religion and politics. And you get pontifical opinions from airheads galore. They've never studied anything about religion because they assume you don't have to. Well, I lost my faith and lost it in college because I was met with a rather opaque but invisible wall that subtly said to me I could not get my academic wings or be considered intelligent until I abandoned the faith I'd grown up in that looked on Jesus Christ as a good and wise teacher. But something in addition to that, the Son of God, supernatural, a revelation of God's own nature, moved into a tent of human flesh and revealing to us what God is like. That part they didn't want. A good and wise teacher, yeah. But I could not get academic wings until I abandoned any faith in the supernatural. All I would be left with is what they offered me. Gotta get rid of this word, but I'll write over it. Remember, it's a good word. I'll use it a lot in the days ahead. Good and wise teacher. Now the church claims that in Jesus you meet God. John says in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word, which is to be facing God, and the Word was of the same essence as God. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And the Greek word is to strike a tense, out of military language. He struck a tense and dwelled among us. And though no man has seen God, the 18th verse of John's Gospel says, Christ hath declared him, and I've illustrated this many times to this congregation. The word is exegesis in the Greek. It means to lead from behind the curtain and put on display. God, who was not seen, came out from behind the curtain and put himself on display in a tent of human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth. And when we meet this person walking on the stage of history, we encounter God. That's the claim of the church. My academic mentors said, oh, no, no, no. Good and wise teacher, yes. Supernatural Son of God, X that out. I bought it for a while. But I want to tell you today, it's not allowable. And anybody who takes that position reveals themselves to be a total ignoramus of the facts of history about the only Jesus you can find in history. What my professors told me, he's the founder of religion, put him on the plateau with Muhammad, with Buddha, with Confucius, and just put Jesus in that camp. And then you can be respected as an intellectual. Good and wise teachers who founded a religious faith whose followers exaggerated them into divinity. I encountered that at Stanford when Dr. Kishimoto, who took the place of Anasaki as a leading Buddhist scholar in the Far East, he was 5 years in this country studying religion here, Union, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford. I took his comparative religion class in my doctoral program, sat about 2 months. I'd already settled my own faith. Could not tolerate it any longer as he paralleled what he called the development of Buddhology with the development of Christology, a faith that the founders divine. Big flaw. Big flaw. You can trace in the tripart basket of scriptures that's the basis of all Buddhism, both the northern and southern branches, and the unique branches, Zen Buddhism and others that spring up along the coast of Asia. They all come from the same source, the preachings of a prince in India, who, having a sense of bondage to what they call tanya, or thirst for the things of this life, sought deliverance, first the way of the ascetic yogi, then the way of the sensualist to lose himself in pleasure, found no satisfaction, then had an experience that produced a trance-like state where he lost any sense of identity with the things of this world. An eightfold path, he called it, and all he could say is, it worked for me, I leave it for you. And we have his scripture, or his messages in the basket of scriptures that's the basis of Buddhism. Sermon after sermon, he denies any supernatural quality. All he did was experience the touching of the that, which is behind all that, their view of what ultimate reality is. They won't even give it a name. Nirvana, their salvation or religious experience, was to reach a trance-like state where they no longer feel a sense of identity with things down here. And having touched that, the karma doesn't roll any longer, and they will die and become one with ultimate reality. And he said to his followers, my death means nothing. My life means nothing. All I leave you is a way that worked for me. Every 200 years in the Samgitas, his followers met. We can trace the history. Every 200 years they met. And after 600 years had passed, you can find the point. They project back onto the Gautama Buddha. They project onto him divinity, saying he could not have said and done what he did unless he were divine. You can spot in history where the followers put the myth back on him and said in his own humility, he did not see his own state. But his record is to deny it. You can respect the Gautama Buddha as a good and wise teacher. He didn't make ridiculous claims. Muhammad, he had visions. Visions a desert man would like. He never claimed to be God. One God, Allah. Muhammad's his prophet. from these visions, you believe he had them, an outside objective criteria, an honest man reporting an experience he had, from those visions we get the Quran. He never claimed any divinity. Confucius made a logical... Now, you don't like what you hear here? When I go to the blackboard, get the funk out. Because I've already decided, I do this every Easter, but I'll catch the ones that come on Easter by surprise and preach something else when Easter rolls around. Every year I preach this message at Easter. Today I'm doing it no matter what the date, because it's the foundation of the Christian faith. And it's not going to be easy as I try to stay within the clock and move rapid fire unless you grab your brain and stay with me. If you want a basis for faith, if you want to walk out of here knowing that the Christian faith can be made intelligent, it was before you encountered this message, but it can be articulated in an intelligent way matching any philosophy, then stick around. I was told by the wise professors, I grew up in my faith when I chopped off a miracle belief in Jesus as the Son of God, a supernatural revelation, put him on this respected plateau with other founders, Buddha, who never made any claims of divinity, Muhammad, who had visions and never claimed divinity, Confucius, who made a logical analysis of society. He said if you would follow his pattern in social behavior, you'd solve society's problems. One city tried it and failed. He said they did it wrong. He never, ever claimed divinity. They asked him about the next life once. He said, I can't solve the problems of this life. So don't ask me about the next one. Only Jesus, of the historic founders, goes about making claims so ridiculous, you cannot call him good and wise. Now, I don't give a hoot or a holler. What's your source? If somebody says Jesus is a good and wise teacher, they're going to have to base it on what he said and what he did. We're dealing with a historic character. I don't care what the source. What source you want to use? You'll always find my professors quoted the Gospels. They'd go to the Sermon on the Mount. Give me all his little sweet sayings. You don't have to stick to the Gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, you can read the Greek. You can find, obviously, Mark was written first. Then you find Matthew and Luke quoting from Mark. As you're reading the Greek, you see the style change. And all of a sudden, Matthew's style and Luke's style changes. And there's another style crops up in certain bodies of the Gospel. And as you read the Greek, you can see they're quoting Mark. Exactly. But behind that, all three of them have contained within their Gospels certain sections of another style. This has come to be called the so-called Q document because it's obvious they had a source behind that. We've had archaeological digs. The Gospel of Thomas out of the Nag Hammadi Gnostic finds, they've tried to present it as a possible Q document source. It's a list of sayings of Jesus. You can go into the sayings of the fathers. You can go into the ancient hymns that are embodied in these various records. I don't care where you go. Wherever you find any source validly accepted by the body and community of scholars who look at these manuscripts, you're going to find somewhere embedded in any one of these sources about Jesus, he's making claims about himself no mortal man has a right to make. He seeks authority in himself. In himself. Buddha pointed to an experience he had. It worked for him. Empirically, he offers this for you to try. His criteria of authority was an outside experience he underwent that he points to the Eightfold Path, the middle way, as a solution. Muhammad, he saw visions. You can believe or disbelieve the visions. But you can't deny the honest conviction of the man. He had an experience. He points to the visions. He says from Allah, this is Allah's word, like prophets of the Old Testament. He claims his insight from that source. He doesn't cite authority in himself, per se. And I've already said Confucius, a logical analysis of society. He presents it to you, take it or leave it. Only Jesus ceded authority in himself. He said, you've heard it said unto you. Quotes the sayings of the Pharisees, the sayings of the Jewish scholars, for the centuries. You've heard it said unto you. But behold, I say, no outside criteria. You're supposed to accept it because he says it. All authority. I'm picking samples from the sources most people go to. Doesn't matter what source. He'll say things like this. All authority is given to me. All authority in heaven and earth. You build on what I say. You build on a rock. You build on anything else. You build on sand. He forgives sin without any criteria other than he's doing it. Here come the religious experts shoving a woman, taken in adultery, caught in the very act. They want to stone her. He forgives her. He listens to the Pharisee pray, the religious symbol of rightness, and he listens to a publican pray, and he says with no criteria other than he says it, the publican's prayer is answered. The Pharisee isn't. He ceded authority in himself. We all hate know-it-alls. You don't make saints of know-it-alls. How many have met one? When they say it, that's it. No criteria other than they say it. Only God can speak, and things become facts. Jesus acted as though all authority resided in him. He thought he was perfect. Doesn't matter whether he was or not. That isn't the point I'm making. He thought he was perfect. We don't make saints of people who never see that they do anything wrong. You ever met one of those? They're never wrong. Thomas Carlyle, the philosopher, said, of all acts of men, the greatest of all sins is to be conscious of none. We hate people like that. All I'm trying to illustrate is most people are ignorant of the Christ of history. They don't know anything about him. They just swallow this garbage, good and wise teacher because it sounds good. You're not throwing stones at him. It puts him off to the edge of your brain. You don't have to deal with it anymore. You're good and wise teacher, and I'm too smart to ever believe that he's supernatural, and I peddle down my self-created image of Christ. I have no knowledge. You cannot put that stamp on Jesus. He was either a nut or a fraud. He either thought impossible things about himself and could be called good because he honestly believed the ridiculous claims, but he couldn't be called wise. Or if he was a fraud, he was wise enough to convince a band of followers that he had these qualities, but he couldn't be good. Because he knew he was lying. No man has a right to make these claims. And as you go down the traits of Christ more and more, he separates from the possibility of calling him a good and wise teacher. You have to put him in the category of Jimmy Jones. You've got to put him in the category of Father Divine. He was either a nut, believing the impossible about himself, not to be respected as a teacher, or he was a wise, cool fraud who could pull it off all the time knowing he was making impossible claims about himself. You don't forgive sin unless you think you're perfect. Scripture says, judge not that you be not judged. The prophets never, ever said, thy sins be forgiven. They said, the Lord will forgive thee. Only Jesus goes around forgiving sins. No sense of moral inadequacy anywhere. The Lord's Prayer is not what we call the Lord's Prayer. Every one of these disciples, or every one of these founders, Now don't fade with me. Every one of these founders prayed the same prayer as their disciples. We call it the Lord's Prayer, again showing some of our ignorance. Jesus never prayed the Lord's Prayer. It's not the Lord's Prayer. It's the disciples' prayer. They said, "When teach us to pray." He said, "When ye pray, say this, Our Father which art in heaven, or who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Among other things, forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those that trespass against us." He never prayed that prayer. Ever. He said, "When ye pray, say this." He had no trespasses to forgive or to be forgiven. His prayer is in John 17, where in the garden he prayed, "Father, I have done what you sent me to do. I've delivered the word that you sent me to deliver. Now, Father, restore me to the place that I had." And in that prayer he prays for us, "Father, keep them all that are with me. While I was with them, I kept them. I'm no longer in the world. I come to thee. Now, Father, you keep them, and then keep those that hear the word they preach, which includes you and I." That's the Lord's Prayer. There's not a shred of a sense of moral inadequacy in it. He thought he was perfect. He knew the Scripture better than anybody. He let himself be designated by John as the Lamb, in the context where the Lamb had to be perfect as the sacrifice. He said he was a ransom for the sins of the world, in the theological concept where, or context where, the ransom had to be a perfect sacrifice. He thought he was perfect. He capstoned it by saying, "You've heard it said unto you, these things," and then says concerning the law, "Think not that I'm come to destroy the law. I'm come to fulfill it." After he had just butchered any shallow idea of law keeping by saying, "You've heard it said unto you, thou shalt not commit murder, thou shalt not kill, but behold, I say unto you, if you hate in your heart, you're as guilty as the murderer." He shoved it past the surface, painting on, and internalized it to where a God who looks at the heart judges according to motives. And in that context, having defined the law as tougher than Moses did, he said, "Think not that I'm come to destroy it. I'm come to fulfill it." Hey, I'm not arguing that he did. I believe he did. But he obviously thought he did. It's that no sense of moral inadequacy. He would present himself as perfect. He talked about the eternal world as though he knew it from the inside. Now, if I say to you, I got pictures all over the wall of my house up the ranch, and you ask me to prove it, I'm going to say, "You're nuts. I don't prove what's in my home." We talk about our home in a way that communicates personal knowledge thereof. I'll talk about your house as a stranger, but there's a tone on the way we talk about our home, personal things. It just communicates. I think you're crazy if you ask me how I know where the bed is in my bedroom. I get there rather frequently. I can find it if I were as blind as a bat. I would not turn into a wall. I know when I go through the door, the bed's on the right. That's the way Jesus talked about eternity. He just matter-of-factly. He didn't say like Muhammad, he had a vision, or like Buddha, who just touched eternity and an experience, or like Confucius, who said, "Don't ask me about it. I don't know anything about the next life." He spoke of eternity in these matter-of-fact terms of, "Before Abraham was, I was. And I was there and saw Satan cast down. I was there when the worlds were formed." He would have us, he talks about mansions in heaven. He speaks of eternity as though he would have me believe that's his home. He's here temporarily. He's going back there, and then he's coming and getting us. Now, come on. Get on board with me. What would you do if I walked in here today? I appreciate the applause because I came here 20 years ago to, of the two goals I had, to restore respect for leadership. But I think that the applause might begin to dwindle. I came in here today and said, all authority in heaven and earth is seated in me. No matter what anybody else says, that's sand. You build on what I say. Now, you would ask for a criteria. I give it to you. Years of scholarship in this book and the roots of Christianity. But I'm not saying that. I'm saying, what if I walked in here and said, it's true because I say it. And there's only one perfect man capable of standing in the place of all of you. I'm it. Now you know you've got the silly grins on your face. I can't even pause long enough to be humorous today. I got so much traffic to go through. But get on board with me. And then I say to you, before Abraham was, I was, and I kid and say I'm the Highlander and you got to cut my head off to kill me and I've been living 473 years. Sure, everybody knows I'm joking. What if I believed it? Walked out here today and said, my mom had a dream thinking I was birthed by her. I've been around since Abraham was. I'm not talking about reincarnation. I'm talking about before incarnation. I've been here all the time. Let me tell you about eternity. Tell you where heaven is, what it's like. What would you think of your pastor? I either need to go to the hospital or I need somebody to jerk my chain. I'm either a fraud or I'm flipped. Now try to get past the traditions that make void the truth. This is the only Jesus you're going to find in history. I at least respect the Jews for recognizing if he was not what he claimed to be, he was a blasphemer. What I cannot stand is this milk toast dismissal of Jesus by saying, oh, I respect him. I put him in the category with the founders of religion. No, you can't. He's either an outright nut or a fraud. That isn't all. He said there's something wrong with the world. It can only be set right by me. Wrong world. I make it right. No one else can make it right. By dying, my death somehow removes a barrier that no one else can remove between man and God. I and I alone can pay the ransom and redeem the world. That in the context where he made himself the center of the universe, of the religious universe. He didn't come preaching a way of life apart from himself. He didn't, like Buddha, offer an experience that he shared, like Muhammad, a path out of a vision, insight that came to him, a practical, logical way to handle social affairs from a logical analysis of society. Jesus came striding on history presenting himself. He didn't offer another way. The Sermon on the Mount was designed to prove the inadequacy of their attempts to keep the law. He presented himself. He said, I'm the door. Now, imagine me saying this today. Talk about a cult. Let's assume we gather here at the cathedral because I'm telling you, I'm the door. By me, you get into heaven. I'm the door of the sheep cut. You go in any other way, you're a thief and a robber. I'm the water of life. I'm the light of the world. He that hateth not father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister, yea, and his own life also, and taketh up his cross and cometh after me, can't make it. He that preferreth father, mother, wife, children, brother, sister, and his own life to me, Can't make it. I'm the rock. I'm having a real hard time mentally reaching out and grabbing your brain and saying, I'm serious about this. Get flesh and blood into this arena and stop whistling poetry about Jesus. Either have the guts to dismiss it entirely, say I don't need him, and I want to tell you going out the gate, Confucius has a much better golden rule than Jesus. Jesus isn't what he claimed to be. I want no part of it. Because Jesus' golden rule says, do unto others as you wish to be done unto. And that's become an excuse for religious knotheads cramming their junk down our throat throughout centuries. Confucius says, don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. I much prefer that if all we can get out of Jesus is a practical speech about life patterns. Jesus offered himself. And having offered himself, said his death and his death alone would somehow right what was wrong with the universe. He said his death was a ransom. In the context where a ransom was the price you paid for an unclean animal that the law said must die. A ransom was the price you paid for someone who through mistake had lost their inheritance and you had to buy it back. A ransom was always a price to restore a precious inheritance or to remove the necessity of death in order that life might continue. Jesus said his death ransomed the whole world. You've got to be a nut to believe that. You can't be called wise because you're nuts. You can only be called good if you're nuts. You can be called wise if you're a fraud. That means you're no good. What have I accomplished? I hope a little bit of insight that most people who talk about Jesus don't know funk. That's all. Just admit their funkin' ignorance. That's all I want. Get off my case. I don't give a funk. I don't give a funk whether or not they follow Jesus. I just want them to get off my ass with their ignorance. I'm tired of Christians walking around hunkering down over these intellectual snobs that don't know funk. Am I using that word enough? You heard this message for 20 years. You never heard it so funkin' good. Send this one to your relatives. I put up with this ever since I was a freshman in college. These snide intellectual assholes. Too lazy brain to pay attention. I respect any man says, it's so impossible to believe that he was the Son of God, I don't even want to talk about it. But don't start telling me you know anything about Jesus and open your fool mouth and say, well, I believe he's a good and wise teacher. But I can't believe this supernatural stuff. Well, why do you have to believe he's a good and wise teacher? Well, because of what he said and did. I just told you what he said and did. He made a fool of himself. Or he was a fraud. And then he said, I'm going to die to pay this ransom. And 3 days later, I'm going to raise from the dead. I want to tell you something. Dr. Craig Lent came in here not having seen him for a few months and announced to me he had just discovered that he was the seat of all authority. And that whether I knew it or not, he was perfect. And he had something to tell me about eternity because it just came back to him. He had had some kind of amnesia for a while, but now I remember. That's where he'd been all the time. He was here temporarily. And that there was something wrong with the world that he was going to set right. And the only way we could make it into heaven or whatever you want to call the good side of eternity was to make him the center of your religious life, follow him and worship him, believe all this stuff. And he was going to die, and the shedding of his blood would pay the price to redeem the lost inheritance for all mankind. By then, I'd be ready to pop one, because I'm embarrassed at the association. And that's why Jesus' family wanted to lay hands on him. They thought he was crazy. They were smart. They thought he was crazy. But if old Craig died the death that he prophesied, and 3 days later, to the hour, he comes out of that tomb, I'm going to take another look at old Craig. That's all I need to know. You can go around making these claims, and I'm going to think you're nuts or putting me on. But if you come out of that grave 3 days later, are seen, alive and well, and then I watch you sail off in the blue, saying you'll come back and get us someday, I'm going to take another look at Craig. I came to that conclusion that there was one thing I had to settle. Did he raise from the dead? Now, I want to tell you, most people will argue in a circle. A resurrection's impossible. Therefore, it didn't happen. Therefore, anybody who says it did is a poor reporter or a liar, because a resurrection can't occur. Therefore, it didn't occur. Therefore, anybody who says it did is a liar, because a resurrection can't occur. Therefore, it didn't occur. Anybody who says it did, not worth reading, because a resurrection can't occur. Didn't occur. You with me? That's arguing in a circle. You say everything you're going to say in your first statement. What Christianity says, this amazing person who stepped on the stage of history, about whom very intelligent people who have shaped this whole world, who've looked at the evidence, have come to believe is what he claimed to be. And I want to tell you, if Craig Lamp raised from the dead, this is all the definition of God I need. One who is the seat of all authority is my starting point for truth. The one who was perfect, you'd have to be perfect or be dishonest in thinking he was, is an adequate substitute in my place. Since I think this life is but preparation, and that mystery beyond the grave called eternity, I'm quite happy to know that I can listen to one who knows it from the inside. He set all things right for us. And my position in eternity is not based on my perfection, but my trusting relationship to him, this person who died for me and who came to reveal what God is like. If I can be convinced that you came out of that tomb, then I'll take the rest of this package. And that's all the definition of God I need to relate myself and start a life to build on. I, therefore, had to settle it. Not enough to say it couldn't happen. What Christianity says, no, it can't happen by anything we know. And it's not enough that he rose. It's that the one who made these claims came out of that tomb. That verifies and puts validity on the claims and suddenly grabs all philosophy and crushes it down to this one tent of human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth, who did walk out of eternity and tells me what God is like, and I can listen to him instead of Jimmy Swaggart. all these other religious crud that ought to get the funk out. I have a starting point for faith. I don't have to go anywhere else. If he came out of that tomb, that's all I need to know to start my life building on what he had to say. And everyone, as I've said, just assumes it can't happen, therefore it didn't. It's a historic event. Now, historic certainty, I got an undergraduate major in history. Historic certainty, by definition, requires all logically available evidence be in. Therefore, by definition, the logically available evidence of being an eyewitness is no longer available. So all historic certainty, any student of history comes to know this, is relative. You can never reconstruct. None of us were eyewitnesses in the murders for which O.J. Simpson was charged. You make your decision on the evidence that's available. But there's no eyewitness. Likewise, there's no eyewitness still living and talking to Jesus' resurrection. There's records of those who were eyewitnesses, which means our evidence is better than what the prosecutors had in the O.J. Simpson case. But psychological certainty comes from exposure to the evidence. You look at the evidence long enough, you're either going to tilt guilty, not guilty, or remain agnostic, not knowing. My quarrel with people about Jesus is they don't look at what the sources are enough to figure out. They've got to kick him out. Muhammad, Buddha, Confucius never made any such ridiculous claims. Only Jesus made these kinds of claims about himself personally. So either admit you're ignorant of Jesus, or face up to the fact and have the guts to call him either a fraud or a nut. Likewise, on the resurrection, either have the gonads to admit, I've never looked at the evidence, and quit acting like you're a know-it-all who's looked and you're not convinced, because I've been around on this subject for a long time. From my days when I had to challenge my professors, including Dr. Kishimoto, where I challenged his so-called parallelism of Buddhology and Christology, as I referenced earlier, and convinced him, and then got invited to a year of personal individual study with him as he examined the claims of Christianity and instructed me in these Oriental religions. I've never found, including him, never found a professor, never found a student, never found a person educated or uneducated. There may be one, but in many years, I have yet to meet the first person who denies the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but what I can ask him five questions and find he has not spent 15 hours in his entire life looking at the evidence. Well, this is the most earth-shaking claim ever intruding onto the stage of history. Brilliant men through the centuries have looked and believed it. Your whole life is revolutionized as a consequence if it's true. You've got to be a nut to not spend 15 hours looking at the evidence. I spent 3.5 years, skeptic by nature, doubting as a natural expression. I remember sitting in a peach cannery as a bureaucrat working for the state. I had a wonderful job. 5 minutes an hour I had to work and 55 minutes do nothing. So I studied the resurrection. I remember closing the last book, rocking back in my chair and saying there's only one answer. He came out of that tomb. Now, what am I supposed to do? Which led me back to these claims. I'm telling you by experience, the resurrection is a historic fact. There is evidence to which you can expose yourself, and when you do it, you're going to have a psychological reaction. Either you're going to believe He came out of that tomb, and thus these consequences fall. Or you're going to say, I can't believe it. And at least you have looked at it intelligently, and you'll be the first that I will ever meet who looks and says no. Now, I've reduced, over many years, the evidences of the resurrection down to four. Four reasons why I came to believe, as a hard-headed skeptic, he came out of that tomb. And my faith has flowed through these years, and I've become a captive to the one who said I had to make him first because of that evidence. I didn't make it in 35 minutes. I'm not going to try. If you want to hear those four reasons, you get here next Sunday. I'm finished today. No, I didn't intend to do this when I started. But I'm not going to tag these four reasons that are the most critical evidences of the resurrection on the end of this heavy message. I just want you to go out of here today. This is not a message that reaches into your emotions and touches you where the problem area of your life is that faith turn loose can solve. Those are the messages I've been preaching the last several Sundays. This is the basis for the faith that God will do what He says, keep His promises, and that we do deal with a living, personal God who cares about us enough to give His life for us. All I wanted to achieve today was to communicate, you don't have to be a vacant-headed dummy to be a Christian. There is a solid basis for faith. And it's time for Christians to put their head up high and tell the rest of the world, you'll respect our beliefs, whether you have them or not, and will not tolerate a dumb dismissal of it. Jesus is the most amazing person to stride on the stage of history, that He has maintained respect down through the centuries, having made the claims He made about Himself, is proof positive of the effectiveness of the proof of the resurrection that has changed the lives of powerful mental giants who have communicated His message. And next Sunday, I'll be able to quickly jump past the uniqueness of Christ, who made these claims about Himself, to that which verifies His right to make the claims, the resurrection. I hope you'll be here next Sunday. We're going to close. It's offering time. We're going to close. We're going to close with a song that says, in faith, what really happened. He came out of that grave.